grand poobahs of the nuclear industry love to negate the connection, saying that they are the cure for global warming while they gobble up funds earmarked for genuine clean green renewables. But then someone who has done the deep dig into buried or obscured facts pulls together the research to make the irrefutable global warming nuclear heating connection. And along with a smorgasbord of mind-blowing information, she tells you,
unlike a fossil fuel plant that makes heat once and then gets cold and is cold ash, nuclear plants, once fission starts, continues heating very hot for all of its half-lives until all the half-lives are used up. So you have to multiply the heat every day over years and years and years. And so that heat number, though it may be maybe small on a daily level, when you multiply it out, it becomes quite enormous.
And then she continues with the global heating effect of nuclear and, well, when you get mind-boggling yet crystal-clear information on an aspect of the nuclear debacle that the industry has been propagandizing for years, you discover how you and everyone else has been tricked into not seeing the source of all that heat in the hot, hot, hot seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, an important interview with Susan Hito Shapiro. She is a New York State attorney who has been working on the legal side of nuclear issues, including Indian Point, for years now. She shares what she discovered in her Indian Point research that makes a stunningly clear connection between the heat given off by nuclear fuel and global warming. New information to me, some of which I found so stunning, that many of the background noises you will hear during the interview come from my jaw dropping. That interview will be coming up in just a few moments. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than Los Angeles Dodger fans could have heard through all that ordnance they exploded after the World Series win. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, October 27, 2020, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. The big story this week was, of course, the historic ratification of the United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. It happened on October 24, 2020, when the 50th state party, Honduras, ratified just one day after Jamaica and Nauru submitted their ratifications. The treaty prohibits the development, testing, producing, manufacturing, transferring, possessing, stockpiling, using, or threatening to use nuclear weapons, or allowing nuclear weapons to be stationed on the country's territory. It will enter into force of law 90 days from the 50th ratification, meaning on January 22, 2021, and is the same legal structure that took landmines down and out. We're working on getting an interview on that for next week's show. Ironically, or maybe not, a few days before ratification was completed, Counterpunch ran an article, "Nuclear War Makes a Comeback." Among the quotes in it was this from the International Red Cross: "The risk of the use of nuclear weapons has risen to levels not seen since the end of the Cold War." We'll link to the article on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 488. Over to Japan, where last week,
Based on a report from CBS News, we announced that Japan had finally determined that they will release more than 1 million tons of radioactive water from the wreckage of the Fukushima nuclear facility into the quote-unquote sea, meaning the Pacific Ocean, despite strong opposition from environmentalists, local fishermen, and farmers. Pushback was loud, relentless, and international. In South Korea, demonstrators ramped up their protests against Japan's plans to dump the radioactive water into the ocean. And the governor of the province of the South Korean island Jeju vowed that he would launch both domestic and international lawsuits against Japan should it release radioactive water from the wreckage of the Fukushima nuclear plant into the Pacific Ocean. Greenpeace sounded the alarm by saying that this policy was not based on scientific or environmental protection principles, had no justification, and warned about the presence of carbon-14 in the water, which science has shown to have the potential to damage human DNA. Greenpeace said that TEPCO's controversial plan was founded on, quote, a series of myths, and pursues the cheapest option to get rid of the water over what is best for human and ecological health. A survey by Japanese daily newspaper Yomiuri Shimbun shows about 50% of citizens in Japan were against this plan to discharge radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean, all of which inspired Japan to put off the decision to release this radioactive water into the ocean. The Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry claimed that this decision was triggered by strong opposition from fishermen, not bothering to mention everybody else. But having failed to figure out how to clean up the contamination from one nuclear disaster has not stopped Japan from qualifying for
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
In Japan, the Miyagi Prefectural Assembly has approved a nuclear reactor restart, despite not only very strong public opposition, but being only slightly more than 60 miles away from the site of the Fukushima Daiichi triple meltdown of March 11, 2011. That's bad enough, but the numbnutsery is that in every article that I have seen dealing with this, there has not been a single reference to Fukushima Daiichi, nuclear power reactor triple meltdown, radiation releases, or anything that might bring up the specter of what happened there almost 10 years ago. It's referred to as a tsunami-afflicted prefecture. Sometimes there are references to the earthquake, but never, never do you see anything that deals with the nuclear disaster that happened there and is still going on. This seems to be the latest ploy in the come on down to the Olympics in 2021. They should only COVID be allowed to happen. And it seems like this ban on nuclear information is being implemented across the board in Japanese media. So that is why journalists and or editors in Japan, you, for eradicating mention of Fukushima in relevant stories, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
In the United States, in Utah, Murray City becomes the fourth city from that state to exit the small modular nuclear reactor scheme to place 12 of these untried nuclear reactors at the Idaho National Laboratory in Idaho Falls. Their concerns are primarily financial, because the project's projected costs have ballooned significantly from $4.5 billion a few years ago to around $6 billion now. And knowing the trend with nuclear, it's going to be double or triple that if it moves forward. As of now, this subdivision of 12 untried small modular nuclear reactors is only 25% subscribed, so it may not happen after all. Beyond Nuclear is calling for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to fix potentially fatal flaws in 19 GE Mark I boiling water reactors, the same design that melted down at Fukushima. What is needed is for the currently deficient hardened containment vents to be replaced. The 19 reactors are sited in 10 U.S. states. So if you find yourself living in Alabama, Georgia, Illinois, Michigan, Minnesota, North Carolina, Nebraska, New Jersey, New York, or Pennsylvania, We'll have a link up to the Beyond Nuclear article on our website. We will also link to a Union of Concerned Scientists article written by Ed Lyman, their Director for Nuclear Power, Safety, Climate, and Energy. It's entitled Earthquakes and the H.B. Robinson Plant, a case study of the NRC's failure to learn from the Fukushima accident. And Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds.org has written a very frightening article, Nuclear Radiation Alert, Could You Have a Dirty Bomb Next Door? And the answer is not one you're going to like. Two scary articles, just in time for Halloween, and of course we'll link to them. In Russia, researchers have discovered that bumblebees exposed to levels of radiation found within the Chernobyl exclusion zone suffered a significant drop in reproduction that scientists say should prompt a rethink of international calculations of nuclear environmental risk. In Kyrgyzstan, in the former Soviet Union, decades-old uranium stockpiles are threatening the water supply of millions of people in the mountainous peaks of that country. And there's a mountain valley that is considered to be one landslide away from radioactive catastrophe. Nuclear radiation, the gift that keeps on giving, whether you want it to or not. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, there are so many issues begging for our attention and involvement these days that it's hard to know where to look or what to do or what's going to help you feel fulfilled and like you're really making a difference. I could go through the societal list, the international list, but let's face it, we've all got our own lists, and it's hard to know where to put our attention. As a result, nuclear is rarely at the top of the list, but it deserves to be there right at the top. Because bombs around the world are on hair trigger alert. Reactors leak and heat the water, as you will hear in today's interview. There is no plan for long-term radioactive waste storage, and no site polluted with radiation has ever been completely cleaned up. That puts all of us at risk. And that is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. We know where to look for the nuclear story, know the questions to ask, and then report it back. The ongoing, evolving nuclear truth that the industry would rather we not hear about, let alone understand. And mainstream reporters don't know to ask. That's why, if you want to support us, now would be a great time. A donation of any size helps. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button. That's where you can set up a one-time or a recurring donation of any size. Remember, $5 a month is the equivalent of a cup of coffee and a nice tip here in the U.S. So do what you can now. If nothing else, buy Nuclear Hot Seat a cup of coffee. I promise you that isn't the form it will take. Please do what you can now and know that however much you can help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. Every so often, I get surprised by an interview. And this one on the nuclear climate change connection still has me reeling. I consider this cornerstone information, so fasten your seatbelts. Susan Hito Shapiro is a New York State attorney whose practice focuses on environmental water protection and land use in the Hudson Valley. She was co-counsel on the groundbreaking litigation against Indian Point's violation of the Clean Water Act for thermal and radiation pollution of the Hudson River, and against the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for reducing fire safety standards at Indian Point. She laid the legal groundwork opposing relicensing of Indian Point, participated in the President's Blue Ribbon Commission on Nuclear Waste, and has represented nuclear whistleblowers. After hearing Susan speak on a radiation and public health Zoominar, I knew I had to get her back on the show. We talked on Friday, October 16, 2020. Susan Hito Shapiro, it's a joy to have you with us this morning on Nuclear Hot Seat.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Let's start out with your background. You are an attorney, so what is the nature of the law that you studied, and how did you get involved with nuclear issues?
The kind of law that I practice is it's called Article 78. So I primarily sue the government and municipalities for wrongdoing, for not following the laws. That's the kind of law I do, primarily with land use issues in Rockland County, New York, and elsewhere, Orange and Rockland, New York. That's primarily my law practice. But I wasn't always a lawyer. So I came from a very different background. I came from being a filmmaker in Los Angeles and then moved back to New York, where I'm from, because my father was ill right before 9/11 happened. And then when 9/11 happened, I had very young children who were in my daughter was in preschool, 3 miles from Indian Point. I had not really thought very much about the nuclear issue. I was always, you know, involved with like the June 12th rally and all these different events that were happening, but more as a filmmaker than as an activist. And I realized on 9/11 that the terrorists had flown directly over Indian Point and that my three-year-old daughter was 3 miles away. And at that moment in time, everyone where I lived, all the mothers and parents realized that if they had decided to hit Indian Point, we would have been gone, first of all. But second of all, if there had been a nuclear emergency, we would not be allowed to get our kids if they were in the 10-mile radius and we were 11 miles away. So that's how I became an activist. Because as a mom with young kids, that's the first thing you think about is how am I going to get to my kid? And so I got involved starting with the KI, potassium iodide, and getting the schools to start carrying it. And the more I got involved as an attorney, I started looking at what the laws were. And the first case that I really got involved with was regarding the closed cycle cooling at Indian Point, the superheating of the Hudson River. And Richard Brodsky, who was a state assemblyman and also a brilliant attorney, and I took that case on. And my first client as a lawyer was Pete Seeger, along with the other people. I had never really practiced law. I had passed the bar, and 20 years later was the first time I started practicing law. So we started looking at the laws, and the law is that they are not allowed to dump hot water into the Hudson River under the Clean Water Act. And that's what we brought that case. And ultimately, we did win that case. And ultimately, it was one of the linchpins, as we like to say, is one of those straws in the camel's back that knocked down Indian Point finally. There were many of them, and there were many really amazing activists that worked on that effort, and everyone coming from a different angle. But this issue of the closed cycle cooling really was something they could not overcome. They tried to come up with different systems and blah, blah, blah to try to make it work, but it never made sense. And it got me focused, though, on the issue of that nuclear energy superheats the water and that we're talking about heat and how much heat is a nuclear plant actually creating and how much heat does it put into our ecosystem? And I remember early on talking to people and at the NRC is like, oh, don't worry about the heat. It just goes out over at night. It goes out into the atmosphere. Well, that's nonsense. We're in a closed system. The stratosphere and the troposphere and the Earth system is a closed system. The heat doesn't just go away. It goes around. And we're adding heat every single day from nuclear plants. And so for years, I kept trying to talk to, the elders in the anti-nuclear community about this issue. To be honest, almost every single one was, it's not worth even calculating. Because I figured somebody must have calculated how much heat. And nobody had ever actually calculated it. There was no studies on it. There was nothing on how much heat. Of course, we now know about waste heat and how much waste heat nuclear produces. And what I started looking at and really getting focused on was, unlike a fossil fuel plant that makes heat once and then gets cold and it's cold ash, nuclear plants, once fission starts, continues heating very hot for all of its half-lives until all the half-lives are used up. So you have to multiply the heat every day over years and years and years. And so that heat number, though it may be maybe small on a daily level, when you multiply it out, it becomes quite enormous. And so it took me many years to find somebody in the anti-nuclear movement who was willing to work with me on this, who was a physicist who really understood this. Because I'm not a physicist and I don't really understand enormous numbers and how to work these numbers. And so Marvin Reznikoff finally, after many years, said, you know what, you're really onto something. And he and I worked on actually doing a snapshot as to what the real amount of BTUs nuclear energy has produced over its lifetime since its initiation to today. And of course, it continues forward. It doesn't end. The spent fuel is still hot. So we calculated it, and it roughly turns out to be enough heat to melt about half the world's ice. You know, if you just look at BTUs, and we're just looking at numbers, we're just looking at, you know, how much heat do you need to melt the ice caps versus how much BTUs has nuclear created? And the number is about 50%. It turns out nuclear only produces 11% of the energy. So the math just, you know, you look at the math and you go, that's insane. How can we nobody be thinking about this heat? So that's how I first started getting involved with it, because I just was looking at heat. You know, I know that's a very abstract, and some people would say the numbers that we came up with don't mean very much because, for example, the sun is hotter. Granted, yes, the sun is hotter, but this is new heat. This is heat that didn't exist before, that would not have existed if there wasn't nuclear energy. And it's continuous heat. We're continually heating the planet. We looked at 400 nuclear plants worldwide and used those numbers based on 400 nuclear plants. And we based our numbers on the standard fuel. But now everybody's using high burn-up fuel. So the numbers are even higher than what we calculated because high burn-up fuel is hotter. Why did everyone call nuclear hot? Because it's really hot. That's the truth. It's the hottest thing that human beings have ever done on the planet. There is no other technology that we have that's hotter than nuclear. So I believe that we have to consider that direct heating. I'm not discounting fossil fuels and the greenhouse gas effect. No doubt about that, that holds the heat in. But nuclear is directly heating the planet. That's how I got involved with it. But now what's happened, it's very interesting because for years, you know, I've been working on this issue and really thinking deeply about it. Now, people have started to realize that we do need to talk about nuclear in the world of climate change and the future of sustainable energy. And the economists have come on board. And we have economists who have said the problem we have with the continuation of nuclear energy is the continuation of old nuclear plants and the concept of building new nuclear plants. Two different issues, but they're similar, is that the subsidies for that, that the nuclear industry has been able to get from our government, from our state governments primarily, has been taken away from renewables, and it's going to slow and actually stop and kill our ability to become sustainable and renewable energy. So the monies, so Army Lovins just recently wrote an article about how nuclear is not an answer to climate change, and Mark Jacobson and Mark Cooper, Sovacool from Sweden, they're all starting to look at this issue of the economy, that nuclear's economics basically sits on top of renewables and squashes them and prevents renewables from coming online. So that's the other aspect of nuclear and climate change, that it really is an economic problem. Because, for example, well, we know what's going on in Ohio, where there's corruption, where Exelon, you know, bribed elected officials to get their subsidy. Well, we know in New York State, there's $7.6 billion going to keep upstate nuclear plants that are rusting, corroding, falling apart, leaking into Lake Ontario going. And that's coming out of what they call the clean energy standard. So the whole concept of that standard was to build renewable energy in New York State. But the real thing that's happening out of it is it's supporting old nuclear plants to stay open. Out of that project, that clean energy standard, renewables are getting $1 billion and nuclear is getting $7.6 billion. So that's that playing field is so twisted and skewed that that's one of the real climate change issues.
A lot of people would say, well, prove it. How can you prove that there is this connection between climate change and nuclear energy and the heat that is given off? Have there been any studies? And if so, who has been behind them? And if not, why not?
The few studies, like I said, have been economic studies. But one of the first things I saw is I thought was really sort of surprising and shocking was when I looked at climate change charts and I matched it up to when nuclear plants came online, they almost match identically. They literally, from the 1970s up, you know, when all these nuclear plants were up and running, climate change and nuclear go hand in hand. And so, you know, just looking at that, it was like, wow, that was sort of a surprise I didn't expect to see. So I could send you those charts and you could see that. The other way that it's provable is nuclear is not zero emissions. Nuclear is not greenhouse gas free. Nuclear is not carbon free at all. So now I'll break that down a little bit, because in terms of emissions, the reason it's hard to know exactly how much is because they don't monitor. So there are certain things out of nuclear plants that have never been monitored out of a nuclear plant, such as carbon-14. Every nuclear plant creates new carbon atoms that are radioactive, and they're released as CO2, as radioactive CO2. But they've never been measured, because way back when, in the 70s, actually when there was a document dump when Trump first became president by the EPA, all these documents came out from the 70s that they knew that nuclear was creating carbon-14, which is, it actually has a really dangerous human body impact. Cindy Folkers wrote a wonderful article about it that's up on their website, on Beyond Nuclear's website, on the impact of carbon-14 on the human body. But carbon-14 is actually new carbon. The difference with, let's say, fossil fuel burning and nuclear carbon-14, the release of those carbon atoms, is fossil fuels, the carbon was sequestered in the coal or the oil or the gas. And when it's burnt, those atoms existed. They're just changing state. They're changing from a solid to a gas. Or, well, actually, they stay in solid particulates. But carbon-14, the atoms of carbon-14 from nuclear never existed on the planet. So nuclear is changing the carbon balance on the planet. That's because it's creating new carbon atoms. So that's one aspect. But the other greenhouse gas emissions that we can see nuclear releases is, if you go to any nuclear plant, you see billowing clouds of white water vapor. And we know nuclear plants use a ton of water. They need water to cool. They're constantly sucking in and evaporating water. It doesn't get evaporated as clean water, as just H2O. Any water that goes into or touches a nuclear plant comes out as tritiated water. So that's hot water.
When you say tritiated water, explain just a little about what that means.
What it is it's radioactive water, basically. It's H2O, and it's actually H3O. That's what tritiated water is. So there's one extra hydrogen atom, and that creates it to be tritiated. It acts just like regular water. It looks just like regular water. It goes everywhere like regular water. It goes into the sky. It makes clouds. It does all of that. But that's a greenhouse gas. Water vapor is a greenhouse gas. So this water is hot water. You have to think of all nuclear energy as hot. You know, we get down to that atomic concept of these atomic atoms are hyperactive. You know, they're and they're hot. There's a lot of friction in atomic atoms, which normal atoms are stable and calm. They don't create heat. They don't generate heat. Whereas every radioactive atom creates heat. It's one of the reasons it causes illness. That's why we call it hot. Another one of the greenhouse gases produced by nuclear energy is CFC gases. Now, CFC gases have been acknowledged worldwide to be causing the hole in the ozone. And so it was banned in most countries around the world. The only exception is nuclear energy fuel production. It's exempted from the CFC ban. So nuclear energy is producing less because they've changed the way they do it, but still producing CFC. And then the real kicker on climate change, which is almost sounds like science fiction. When I first heard about it, I was like, you got to be kidding. I can't believe this is even a name of an element. But there's Krypton 85. And right, you have to laugh. It sounds like Superman. But Krypton 85 is actually a man-made element that's only produced from nuclear production. And it is one of the worst climate change accelerators. It comes out of bombs, and it comes out of mostly out of reprocessing. That's where you get the highest hits of Krypton 85. Who told me about this was Kay Kubow. She's one of the early people in the anti-nuclear movement, and she sent me a book recently about it, and there's a whole bunch of articles about it. It turns out that they've known about this for a long time. It's in the spent fuel, and when it gets reprocessed, it's all released. And the problem with Krypton 85 is it goes to the troposphere.
Explain to the listeners what and where the troposphere is.
Okay. So we have our atmosphere, right? Our atmosphere is everything around the world.
The bubble.
The bubble we're in. the world, plus the air that is contained with us. And the lower level is the stratosphere. And that's what CFC gases damages. It puts a hole in the stratosphere. It's an ozone hole in the stratosphere is what CFC gases, which a lot of people understand. The troposphere is the top layer of the atmosphere. It's the very top of the atmosphere. And so Krypton 85 goes right to it. That's where it goes. It's very light. It goes right to the top layer of the atmosphere. And what it's known to do is cause electromagnetic disturbances and magnetic disturbances on the planet. So a lot of these storms, it's related to storms. It's related to electrical storms. A lot of the lightning strikes, the massive strikes that were going on in California, that's what Krypton 85 does. And it doesn't matter that the U.S. is not doing reprocessing. We have France that's doing a massive amount of reprocessing. We know that when they started doing the bomb testing, that Krypton 85 dramatically increased in the atmosphere. They haven't measured it since they've been doing reprocessing. Scientists are starting to look into this. But this is a real serious concern, and it's one of the reasons we have to make sure reprocessing never happens in this country. But what's already happening worldwide, doesn't matter where they're doing it. We're all in a closed system. We're all in this together. You can't separate because it's France and it's the U.S. or it's Russia, or it's China. Whoever's doing it is causing this climate change, this massive worldwide impact on the electromagnetic fields of the planet. That is a real climate change accelerator. So those are the greenhouse gases that scientists know are released from nuclear energy. And it's a big problem that very few people are paying attention to. And my goal is to get more activists involved with this climate change issue and not poo-poo it as, oh, it's not that important, it's so small. I think it may, I'm not saying that fossil fuels are any good. I'm saying the two together exacerbate climate change. Nuclear and fossil fuels together, we don't need either. We can become a sustainable energy future. We have the technology. We have the ability to do it. We just don't have the will and the finances because those two industries are sucking all the money out and not letting us transfer to a sustainable energy future.
We'll continue with this interview with Susan Hito Shapiro about the climate change nuclear connection in just a moment. Right now, I want to remind you that Nuclear Hot Seat is supported solely by listeners. So if you find what you're hearing of interest, help us keep delivering it to you every week. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the big red donate button, and follow the prompts. Anything you can do to help will help. Now, back to Susan Hito Shapiro and the climate change nuclear connection. Starting with this insert. As so often happens in our aftertalk, Susan remembered an important concept she felt necessary to our understanding of the nuclear heat issue. Here it is.
So one of the issues that is acknowledged is that the fuel cycle, the entire life cycle, I should say, of nuclear is not carbon free. In fact, the amount of carbon, and this is well known and accepted and people talk about it all the time, that the carbon footprint of nuclear from mining through reprocessing to shipping to storage to the whole process is much greater than renewables in efficiency, where it's less than it's not much less, but it's a little bit less than natural gas. But it's dramatically more than renewables. So that is an accepted truth, that the nuclear life cycle is not carbon free. But what the nuclear industry has promoted is the moment they make the energy, that they're not making carbon. But that's false. That's the false nugget.
That's one of the things that I have pointed out repeatedly when I do public speaking, when I do podcasts or broadcasts, is that the nuclear industry wants us to take a steel plate with a tiny pinhole in the middle of it and squint through that at the moment that the energy is created and say, see, look, it's carbon free. But if you take that steel plate away and look at the entire fuel cycle, you see that it's carbon intensive every step of the way, except perhaps for that split instant. And the carbon toll is enormous. The greenhouse gas toll is enormous. But they have managed through their propaganda to get us to focus down on just that one split instant.
But that, even that one split instant, they're false about. Because at that one split instant, they're making carbon 14. and they're making tritiated water, and they're making CFC gases, and they're making krypton 85. So in that one split instance of the production of energy, it's not greenhouse gas free. It's far from it. So that's one of the big, what you just said, this whole thing about they want us only to look where they want us to look. They want us to look at these minute little segments of things. That's sort of the problem with the concept of the heat from nuclear, because the whole mentality we have is a Polaroid. We take a snapshot and it's like that moment. That's all we're looking at. We don't look forward, backward. But nuclear's impacts, both health-wise and heat-wise, are cumulative. It doesn't go away. Just because today it released X amount, it doesn't mean that when you have to add it together. You can't take averages. The whole nuclear construct is based on averaging these emissions. And you can't average emissions. You have, in nuclear, you have to add every day to every day. And it's a cumulative impact. And that is how they've actually skewed the numbers, by averaging everything. So they average 3 months. It means nothing. They average 3 months of emissions. It means nothing.
That's also how they get away with the spike that happens during refueling, because they will take this enormous amount that gets released in a relatively short period of time, in up to 3 days, 3 to 5 days, and they will average it out over a year. So it looks like this tiny amount on a daily basis, when really you're getting the bulk of it in a very short period of time.
And you have to add it to figure out your year dose. You have to add it together. You can't average it. So every day, you know, you have those spikes, and then some days are lower, and then you have spikes again. All of that needs to be added together, and that's your annual dose. They average it as a daily dose. It means nothing. So that's one of our problems.
What is another one of the problems?
Now that we're caught up on the basics, we pick up again on the specifics of the nuclear heat climate change connection.
You know, I've been doing this show for almost 500 episodes now. This is going back more than 9.5 years. And in all that time, this is the first time I am encountering this information. So it has to be obscure if it hasn't crossed my plate yet. And I thank you for sharing it, let alone with the specificity and the passion with which you are doing it. Now, you just started going into some of the economics. And one of the phrases I heard you use on a recent webinar was triple dipping. That financially speaking, the nuclear industry is triple dipping into funds. What does that mean?
What it means, this has to do with the decommissioning funds and the funds for nuclear waste. So we have to go back to a little history of when nuclear plants were sited in the States, there was an agreement that this waste would be taken by the Department of Energy. And that it was the Department of Energy's responsibility to take this waste away from reactors. And reactor owners went into financing their reactors, even though they got tons of subsidies to do it, public subsidies primarily to do it. They went forward building reactors with the agreement that they would not be responsible for the waste. So now we fast forward to today. We don't have a waste plan. There is no waste plan in this country, nor will there ever be a waste plan, because there is no place on the planet that's safe for nuclear energy waste to be stored. It's just the reality. The only solution to nuclear waste is stop making it and then take an enormous amount of funding for scientists to study how to reverse engineer the waste, which is how you and I first met, through the idea that that was even possible, through Dr. Roy. But that's not happening. So what happened is the nuclear reactor owners sued the DOE because they were now storing the waste on site. And they said, well, you were supposed to take it, so you're costing us money to store it on site. And so you have to pay us every year a certain amount of money because you're not taking the waste like you promised. So they won that lawsuit, and they've been getting money for years now for this waste that has never gone away from the nuclear sites where it was created. Now, what's happening is these plants are shutting down, and there are decommissioning funds. That's our public money that has been put aside that was supposed to be held by our states to be able to decommission these plants and restore the land when the plants closed and bring it back to a safe state. First of all, the decommissioning funds were never funded properly for many, many years. I mean, there's a history I know of at Indian Point where in the 2008 crash, Indian Point lost most of their decommissioning funds because they gambled it on the stock market. So we lost billions of dollars in decommissioning funds. So now they've built some of it back up, but they don't have all of it. So there's still, you know, quite a bit of money there. So now we have a company like Holtec who's coming in and saying, but we want the NRC to give us an exemption from using the decommissioning funds for decommissioning. We want to use that money because we have to put these casks in dry storage, and we want to use the decommissioning funds for storing the waste. So now the public is paying. We've already paid for the DOE not taking the waste from the nuclear industry, right, from the reactors. So that's already taxpayer dollars. We've paid into the decommissioning fund. That's the second way we've paid. And now the waste, once again, is saying, take the money from the public to be able to pay to store the waste. What they should be doing is the nuclear reactor owners who are now selling their plants to a third party, Holtec or whoever they're selling it to, you know, substandard companies, should be taking the money they receive from the DOE to deal with the waste and transferring that to Holtec to store the waste. Instead, the public is three times paying for the same waste. That's what I meant by triple dipping. And it's a lot of money. It's so unfair.
With the nuclear industry receiving so much money, what have they been doing with this money that perhaps is not in the best interest of the rest of us?
As they have always done, the nuclear industry has spent a lot of money on PR, on convincing the public that they're good for us, that nuclear somehow is beneficial to the human body, that nuclear energy is what we need and that it's cheap and free and good. And so what they've been doing, their new campaign for the last, I'm not sure how many years, but I do know at least when we first met, what was it, 5-6 years ago?
I think it's closer to about 7 or 8 at this point.
Okay, so at least for the last 8-9 years, the nuclear industry has been spending a ton of money in greenwashing nuclear energy, greenwashing it to say that it's zero emissions. It is one of the biggest lies there is. But the biggest problem we have is elected officials have bought it. And we, the anti-nuclear movement, has sat back and said nothing. We have been silent on this issue. We're just starting to talk about it. We have a big uphill climb because nobody wanted to pay attention to this 10 years ago. But right now, the majority of the public and elected officials believe that nuclear energy is zero emissions. And it's better, and we have to use nuclear because look how horrible carbon is. The carbon, like I've said before, is not the only greenhouse gas that causes climate change or that accelerates climate change. There are other greenhouse gases that are even worse than carbon that are accelerating climate change. But nuclear industry has spent billions of dollars in PR money. And I don't want to name names, but there are many green organizations that are anti-fossil fuels, that are pro stopping climate change, such as 360 with James Hansen as the head, who says he's pro-nuclear because he believes that, well, nuclear is better than fossil fuels, that nuclear is carbon-free. That's not true. That's false. It's just scientifically false. It's on the atomic level false. On the not the atomic, like atomic nuclear, like the atom level. The physics of it is not true. Nuclear is not zero emissions. And him promoting that is partially due to the amount of funding he gets from the nuclear industry. If you go into the boards and you look at the boards of Entergy, Exelon, the different board members, and you look at what other boards are they on, you'll find a lot of them on greenwashing corporations that are out there promoting the concept that nuclear is zero emissions. So it's a really difficult battle for us to fight because they've spent billions on it and we don't even have the wherewithal for most people to even care about it. Within our own organization, one of my big frustrations has been there's so much pushback against whenever I talk about it. I honestly, it's one of the reasons I stopped going to meetings. It's like, come on, just open your eyes. This is what's really going on. Nuclear is not zero emissions.
I have to say that since I started this show 9.5 years ago, actually it's more than that now, in watching the flow of information, the greenwashing of nuclear did not seem to be a thing in the immediate post-Fukushima era. And slowly this idea came in and became dominant. I'm also on a lot of email lists from nuclear organizations, and especially their PR arms, which are tricked out. I know how much programs like that cost to put in and to manage and to promulgate. And they've got legions of people working on this because that's where the money is. But I've watched this idea grow without any kind of organized pushback against it. And we say nuclear is not green, but they seem to be louder, more dominant, and have an awful lot more money with which to back that perspective. Plus, they gain access through their board members to the people in power. And somehow, this has become the trope, the mantra that they repeat over and over. And you repeat a lie often enough, it sounds like the truth, when it absolutely is not. How would you, or what are you doing to help us, besides with information, stand against this lie and start turning it around? Or what can we do to join with you to start turning it around?
Well, you know, Beyond Nuclear and NIRS and IPSEC have come around, and we have been fighting this on the state level. You know, NIRS joined us and Beyond Nuclear joined us to challenge the Cuomo subsidy, the $7.6 billion subsidy. We lost that, but the judge did not rule that nuclear is zero emissions. He left that aside. He ignored that cause of action. He just didn't rule on it. So thankfully, he didn't say that nuclear is zero emissions legally, because I think we made a very strong argument, very much of what I'm saying here, and proved it, that nuclear is not zero emission, greenhouse gas emission. That is a false claim. But I think we need to have a more focused campaign to explain the greenhouse gas emissions from nuclear and why they are dramatic climate change accelerators. They speed up climate change. Carbon 14 is a really deadly construct, and all krypton and CFC and the water vapor are all part of the climate change problem. I think what we need to do is get the information out. I think once people see it and understand the basic premise that nuclear is hot, that the heat doesn't just dissipate in the atmosphere, it doesn't go away, it doesn't just go out into space, because that's sort of, I think most people think, well, it's a clear night at sky, it goes out into space. That's not what happens. Heat doesn't just disappear from our ecosystem. We have a closed ecosystem. So I think more people just have to start talking about it. And every anti-nuclear group has to be talking about it. I just wrote a book that I'm trying to get published about this, basically. So I'm in that process. Not that one book is going to make a difference, and I'm not a nationally known figure, but I do know, you know, Mark Jacobson, who is a nationally known figure, has been really strong on this issue. And same with Mark Cooper. And thankfully, Army Lovins finally came around. I mean, I met him many years ago, and he was one of the ones who said, it's not worth calculating. It's such a small amount. Don't worry about it. But now he sees the economics of it. The economics are what's killing renewables. The economics of this PR campaign of nuclear saying that they're green, that they're carbon emissions, and so therefore we have to fund them. Because if we lose them, we're going to end up using more fossil fuels. That's the argument. If we lose our nuclear reactors, look at all the fossil fuels we're going to have to use and how bad that will be for the climate. Agreed, that would be horrible. But those two things don't go together. Instead of spending the money on propping up old nuclear plants, if we took that money over the next 5 years and spent it on renewables, then we would be able to transition directly to renewables. That's what's missing. And efficiency. They're spending the money on an old, passé, dated, outdated technology and refusing to move to the next, to going forward. It's sort of like, you know, at one point in time, there was no indoor plumbing, you know, so people didn't have bathrooms. So it's sort of like saying, well, I'm going to keep building a home with no plumbing because that's the way we used to do it. And though everyone else has plumbing, we're not going to have plumbing because that's what we've always done. Or when chimney sweeps started losing their jobs because we didn't burn coal in our houses anymore, we started using other ways to heat our homes. yeah, they lost their jobs, but then new jobs were created. And that's part of what we need to do. We need to transition our jobs away from old, dirty technologies to new, sustainable technologies. And it has to do with how public funds are used. If we keep using our public monies going backwards, we'll never be able to catch up and go forwards. You can't go in the wrong direction to then turn around and try to go the right direction. But then you have to spend twice the amount of money. And that's the big problem. There's only a finite amount of this money, and it's being spent the wrong way. I know people are fighting these battles all over about the economy, about the nuclear monies going in the wrong direction.
I'm sure that there are people whose eyes have been opened by what you've shared here and maybe feeling a certain level of anger or frustration or wanting to do something. If people were to channel their energies in the short term, saying, hearing this and then going, gotta do something, what would you suggest they do?
Talk to 10 people and explain to them why nuclear is not a solution to climate change and is not even part of a solution to climate change. That's the big problem we have right now. Talk to 10 elected officials and explain to them that nuclear energy is stopping us from becoming renewable energy, that they're taking our money and using it the wrong way. That's what I would say. Go talk to 10 elected officials and explain it to them. It's not that complicated. It's common sense. That's how I came to the whole anti-nuclear movement. It's obvious when you think about it. When you think about the heat from nuclear and you think about the emissions from nuclear that you can see, at a nuclear plant, you see the cloud of tritiated, you know, water vapor that's coming out of every nuclear plant. It's common sense. They're heating the water around every nuclear plant. Fukushima is boiling the Pacific. And the Marshall Islands, the dome that's cracking and falling apart, that heat is going into the Pacific Ocean. And it's super hot around there. Talk to anyone who's ever been in waters around a nuclear plant. They're hot. They're really, really hot. You know, the fish change, the type of flora and fish, the algae blooms, that's all from heat. So it's easy to explain to somebody, just look at the heat from a nuclear plant. They're hot and they don't stop being hot. It's not like you can turn it on and off. It's not fossil fuels where you burn it and the next day it's cold. This is hot for all their half-lives, for centuries.
For more than that, because plutonium has a half-life of 24,000 years.
Correct. Okay, Yucca Mountain. Why did Yucca Mountain fail? You know, everyone says, oh, it failed because of the politics and Harry Reid and blah, blah, blah. It was a scientific reason it failed. It failed because if you bury all that hot spent fuel in a cave underground, it will actually melt the rock. That's why it failed. It's a scientific reason. It can't have deep storage of nuclear. You enclose heat in an enclosed tomb, it will eventually melt it. It's what the dry casks are not going to last 100 years. The heat from nuclear is so corrosive. The heat and radiation, radiation is heat. I think that's what we somehow lost when we call it radiation and isotopes. We forget that all of that is hot. Every single thing, the whole concept of how we have to secure nuclear away from the public is because it's too hot. You burn yourself. You can't get near it. It's so hot. That's why no one could get into Fukushima. It melts everything. The robots melt. Everything melts. It's hot. Heat from nuclear is one of the reasons the entombment of Chernobyl is falling apart. The concrete can't handle the heat. It's why nuclear plants become brittle. It's the heat. It makes the concrete and the steel brittle. Everything about nuclear comes back to this concept that the atom is super excited. They've overexcited the atom, and they've made it run around and become the, and it's hot. That's the heat. And so I think we need to explain that to people on a very simple level, that nuclear is the hottest human activity ever. There's nothing that we've ever done on the planet that's hotter than nuclear. And I'll send you the climate change charts with nuclear, and it's shocking how they match.
I will post any charts that you have up on the website for this interview. Susan, this is a wealth of information you have just shared with us. A lot of it new to the program after 9.5 years. Certainly a lot of it was new to me right now, and I'm certainly it is to the listeners as well. Thank you for the brilliant work that you are doing, thank you for your passion and compassion in putting all of this together, and especially for, on very short notice, being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you for all that you do. You're amazing. You tie us all together and you bring out information to us all the time. So thank you so much. And I love your book.
Thanks, Susan. That was Susan Hito Shapiro, a New York State attorney whose practice focuses on environmental water protection and land use in the Hudson Valley. We will have several links up to the points she referenced. There will be one to Nuclear Hot Seat number 475 from July 28, 2020, featuring Ohio environmental trial attorney Terry Lodge on the Ohio Nukegate scandal. The charts showing the parallel between nuclear and climate change will be there, so you can match them up yourself. There will be a link to the article by Cindy Fokers on the impact of carbon-14. It's on the Beyond Nuclear site. And know that Susan and I are working on developing a short list of talking points to use in discussing the nuclear climate change connection with your elected officials. When they're ready, I'll let you know. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, October 27, 2020. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, Beyond Nuclear, the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, GlobalZero.org, TWAWomenUnited.org, News.UN.org, APNews.com, CommonDreams.org, CounterPunch.org, Dianuke.org, StLouisTribune.com, Fairwinds.org, UCSUSA.org, Hani.co.kr, Ararang.co.kr, world.kbs.co.kr, japantimes.co.jp, thehindu.com, euronews.com, rnanews.eu, and the ever-co-opted Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Hey, make it easy on yourself to get Nuclear Hot Seat every week. Go to our website, nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down for the yellow opt-in box, put in your first name, put in your email address. We won't bug you. We will just send you one email a week with the link to this week's show. You can also find this on your favorite podcast platform. And if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, that's what we count on to keep the lifeblood of this show going. So just send an email if you have any of that information to info@nuclearhotseat.com. We'll check it out, see if we can get it on the schedule. And if you appreciate these weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, take a moment to go to nuclearhotseat.com and check out that big red button. Click on it, follow the prompts, whatever you can do to help us, we're really grateful. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2020, Libby, Halevi, and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevi of Hartestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that on January 22nd, 2021, the Treaty to Prohibit Nuclear Weapons will enter into international law. And if you haven't started celebrating yet, the time to do so would be right now. There you go. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.